Hello, welcome to the Torg Stories podcast, May 6, 2017 edition. Big move for the Torgerson family. I quit my job at St. John's University to become an English teacher and a high school girls basketball coach. So we're headed back to the Hoosier State, and after about 13 years, I'll be back on the sidelines coaching. Guest this week, Edwin Arnodden. He writes about Asheville movies and beer, among other things, for the Citizen Times and Mountain Express. The big news in Asheville this week was that Wicked Weed, a really popular, perhaps the most popular local craft brewery, sold to Anheuser-Busch. So we talk a little bit about that. He was in touch with me to interview, to talk to me about our film on the French Broad River, where my family and I rafted 150 miles of the French Broad River last summer. It's going to screen at the Grail Movie House in Asheville Wednesday, May 24th, 7 o'clock. And then that holiday weekend, Saturday, May 27th, Sunday, May 28th at noon. So love to see some of you guys out at the movie. The Grail is located at 45 South French Broad Avenue. So that's just on the west side of downtown and south. So here comes Edwin, but first some sounds from the Hoosiers. And some stuff from my life growing up in the 80s watching films. So hope you enjoy.
Smart takes the shot, and the Hoosiers with 3 seconds. Go ahead.
But what we found out is that each one of us is a brain and an athlete.
And a basket case. A princess.
And a criminal.
Does that answer your question?
I love you guys.
So let's establish who you are and what you do. So you have a couple different jobs, I think mostly or completely writing. Tell us about that.
I do. So I'm a freelance journalist, and so I feel like to be a freelance journalist and still be able to eat and have a roof over your head, you need to write for multiple publications in Asheville. So I write for the Asheville Citizen Times, doing some movie reviews, and I have been doing some music articles. Hope to keep doing some there, but a lot of work also for Mountain Express, doing beer writing and arts and entertainment, and also doing a weekly column on the local film news. So screenings happening around town, or other projects that are coming together in the Asheville area.
So from where I sit, freelance writing means an enormous amount of writing. Can you give me just a general idea of like what your output is?
My output?
Like, are we talking, you know, how many articles a week? How many columns a week? What are we talking about here?
Well, a lot of it depends on how many movies are coming out on a general week. You know, so like this Friday, there's 4 new releases. There might be 5. And so, having to cover those, and then got the movie column every week, do a local beer news roundup every other week that I'm in charge of, and then usually have about 3 or 4 other full-length articles, whether they're about beer or arts and entertainment, and then other kind of last-minute assignments might pop up too, and you know, the occasional editing as well. So there's no real set hour. This is sort of throughout the week. I like to say that the film reviewer's weekend is kind of Tuesday afternoon through maybe Thursday early afternoon, just because the movies come out, you know, on Fridays and actually Thursday nights now. So kind of a shifted week from a normal 9 to 5.
Right. So let's back up for a second here. You know, I've been teaching in New York. I'm from Indiana. I'm getting ready to move to Indiana. Some people have never heard of Asheville, and they're so like, what is it? But more and more, Asheville is a place that people have kind of vaguely heard of. So when you start to tell somebody not from here what Asheville's like, what's some of the stuff that you point out?
I think first and foremost, it's just the natural beauty of it, because we're just right in this kind of sweet spot of the U.S. where it's, you know, not too hot, not too cold, and just the surroundings of the mountains are just gorgeous. So you just are in this really comfortable place that looks great. So I start with that, and then, you know, that can only take you so far if there's not a lot of stuff to do. So, you know, from the outdoor sports, Biltmore House, just a really nice downtown with a lot of neat shops and arts. And now we have the strong brewing industry with, you know, Sierra Nevada, New Belgium, and Oscar Blues just down the road in Brevard, all having their East Coast operations here. There's just so much to do as well.
So when I say, and I think I would point out about the same things you do, I think the one additional thing I would talk about is just the support of the arts. You know, the way that, for example, I can make our French Broad River movie film, and I think people will come, or at least they came for our documentary about Christopher Mello. And I don't think that would happen in New York. You know, I mean, in New York, it's harder to find that audience. I mean, of course, there's a lot of readings, there's a lot of independent film screenings, but to get people to show up is difficult. But, you know, when it comes to people with working with clay or who are welding or who are painting or who are so that community is super vibrant and supportive of each other. But let me get to the beer a little bit. So there's breweries opening everywhere. So if I'm moving to Indianapolis, or I've got friends who live in upstate New York, or just going up the Hudson 60 miles, they also have breweries everywhere. Do you think that what separates Asheville from that whole scene that's emerging all over the United States, I think?
Well, I would say part of it is kind of the concentration of it in the South Slope part of downtown. I think it's you hear when you're just talking to people that are visiting from Charlotte or Atlanta or wherever they're coming up for the weekend, the fact that they can just park once or, you know, walk over from their hotel and have, you know, 6, 7, 8 breweries just within a few blocks of each other, and just about all of them are making pretty exciting beer, that's pretty rare. And then to be able to have those big boys like the Sierra Nevadas and the New Belgiums right there too, it's just a really nice mix of large and small, and they all work really well together. Everybody's really supportive of each other. I don't know that you find a lot of other beer communities in the country that are as supportive as the Asheville brewers are.
Yeah, I think that's well said. And I asked that question because at first, it was a challenging question for me to answer. And I think you're right about that stuff. So I guess I'm looking at the rabbit hole of talking about beer and deciding how far down I want to go. And I certainly enjoy that community, but probably can't speak very smartly about what I'm tasting. So we'll see how what makes an exciting beer? And, you know, I know you're always running the risk of you can't endorse people and you write about it, and so it's hard to give recommendations. But a couple things that make an exciting beer.
You like to hear about unusual ingredients being used. I'm probably struggling to think about which ones, but if you read a description or you see a beer name that's unusual, you might be drawn to that just because it's so different from just a straightforward IPA or a straightforward porter. You know, if you've got a bourbon barrel-aged vanilla porter or something, you might gravitate towards that than just a straight porter or stout. But then it really just has to come together in the taste for me. You can have the most unusual ingredients in the world, and if it's not flavor forward, if it doesn't have a balanced, nice drinkable experience, then you might as well just pour it down the drain. So I always look for a flavor forward beer, and those typically end up being my favorite breweries around town.
See, you, if there ever is a brewery movie, that was the sort of answer I'm looking for. You're the one who can make the rest of the group. You're the one who can make the rest of the group more wise about what they're drinking. So I might even take a note on the vanilla porter and say, where can I get that? I wanted to back up a second and ask you about, so there's, you know, I think at first I just thought of you in movies, although I'm learning more about that. And then writing. So, you know, when you're 15, when you're 23, you know, did you want to make films? Did you think of yourself as a writer? Did you come to that stuff after college? How did being a writer and focusing so much on movies come about?
Well, the interest in movies has been there from a very young age. I mean, my dad just would, you know, rent, you know, back when we had video rental stores, he would just rent certain things and we would watch them together as a family. And then I just started getting more into that. So, he and I would start watching, you know, more exciting movies together. And, you know, and I had been writing, just for fun growing up and really enjoyed that. But, I did want to be a filmmaker and go to film school. And, you know, for my senior project in high school, I thought I wanted to make a film, and I ended up doing a one act play instead, which was kind of a nice middle compromise. But
yeah.
Kind of working on screenplays on the side and messing around with that and shooting little films with friends. I did that, but it just seemed too daunting to go to film school or even go to take a creative writing major. So I just sort of had the interest of writing and movies kind of on the back burner for the side. And it took a while to be able to kind of meld that into a career, but I'm very glad I've been able to do it.
And you're how old?
33.
And I asked that just because I was sort of wondering, like, some of the big first movies that, you know, movies that were important in your life or what? Because I'm 47, six. I can't even remember how old I am. So that's a really different era, me and you. So what was some of the big stuff when you were moving from middle school to high school?
Let's see.
That's a hard question, I know.
Well, I mean, I remember seeing, you know, back when summer movies, when there were only, you know, a few tent poles, you know, this was kind of the era that Will Smith was coming through.
Yeah,
the
right.
I remember going to see Men in Black and really enjoying that on the big screen, and you know, going to see some Jerry Bruckheimer productions like Armageddon or Pearl Harbor. You know, like back when those were more events and the superhero wave hadn't really come in. So those were special, but. You know, it was really kind of catching up with these kind of very important indie films like Pulp Fiction. You know, sort of watching that on a Friday night with my dad that really kind of really exploded my mind and said, okay, well, this is what movies can be. These are what stories can be on the screen. I mean, I still come back to Pulp Fiction as kind of the turning point for me.
That was a real, you know, and I was mostly. I certainly was into movies, 80s romantic comedies, and I was a reader. But I, you know, thought of myself as a basketball player and somebody who was going to be a basketball coach. So I didn't think real hard about how movies got put together. But Pulp Fiction was certainly one, when it comes to structure and, like, how can you put something together, that was certainly one where I was like, whoa, you don't have to do it this way. So, you know, and that's a pretty cliched thing for movie people to say. I mean, you know, we're... There's probably a million people who would also point to Pulp Fiction for one reason or another. So also,
right.
I'm going to just stay in that. So you were a library science major, right?
I was, yeah.
So does that mean you're a big reader? You were a big reader? And then it's the same question. Like, as you started to move from middle school to high school and so on, what kind of books were important to you?
Let's see. Well, I've always enjoyed reading, but it was just kind of, you know, we would go on spring break vacations as a family, and my mom would always have a book at the beach, and that just seemed like, you know, kind of a cool thing to do, and I was sort of getting more interested in literature, but I wasn't always keeping a book going, so that kind of got me going, and started reading more J.D. Salinger and John Steinbeck. And I actually read a lot of John Grisham growing up, which, you know, I thought I wanted to be a lawyer for a little while, and I got knocked out of that pretty fast.
Was the library, is the library, if you're semi-interested in, if you like to make films and you like to write creatively, was library science kind of a way to keep your foot in that world, but there was a job out there?
Yeah, I think what appealed to me about libraries was, you know, I had worked in the public library books, and then I had a job at the circulation desk in the summer from home from college, and it was just it was a nice environment, and you know, you have people coming in with, you know, generally similar interests if they're there for books or music or movies, so it's just kind of a nice atmosphere to be in. But I guess out of undergrad, I didn't really have the connections to just say, oh, I'm going to go be a writer now. I'm going to go be a journalist. So I thought, well, what can I do for a few years during the day that I can make a living and then I can write on the side and then, you know, eventually transition to writing full time. So that's what I did. I worked in public libraries for 5 years and felt like I was to the point where I could make the move, and I did.
Yeah, great. So you have, tell us about, you have a new website, and I guess first off, just, you know, give us the address, maybe throw in your Twitter handle if you want, since they're pretty tightly connected, but tell us about the website.
Sure. So it's AshevilleMovies.com, and the inspiration for it was, you know, I've been writing quite a bit of reviews for the Citizen Times, and I still do write for them some, but as the print media world goes, you know, there are a lot of budget cuts, and they've had to slash a lot of their core staff, and so one of the most recent cuts was that the freelance budget took a hit, and this was a throughout the whole USA Today network, so a lot of different papers took that hit. So I went from writing about 3 to 5 reviews a week down to 1, and so I thought, well, Asheville has this rich, diverse movie scene. We've got the big box theaters where you get all the mainstream stuff, and then we got the fine arts that's bringing in kind of the upper tier art films, and now we've got the Grail that's showing all sorts of interesting little films. And put that all together, we're right up there with, you know, not exactly Chicago, New York, LA, but pretty close. I mean, at the end of last year, when critics were making their year-end list and were talking about what their favorite films of the year were, there were hardly any that I hadn't seen, and I owe that to how good these bookers are on the local level. So I just feel like that scene deserves to be covered, and you know, I've been told by readers at the Citizen Times that they love the coverage, and so I just feel like this is a way to keep getting the local community informed on what's coming, and I think it's important.
You know, it's a nice hub to bring all those different places that your work goes. It brings it to that one site, even if you're just putting in a headline and linking to it, right?
Right.
Because, you know, like even for me last night or the day before, in reading some of your work, you know, for a lot of those films, it doesn't matter to me if the review is 2 years old or a week old. I'm still interested in hearing what you had to say about film X if I saw it, or film X if I'm thinking about seeing it. So I'm really interested in the business side of filmmaking, which I guess also, I'm interested in. And, you know, how do you have a website? How do you make films? How do you do a podcast where you might make some of that money back? Have you thought at all about, I mean, it looks like you've given a little bit of thought to making that website a little bit profitable. Can you talk about the model for that?
So I've started a page on Patreon, which is a crowdsourcing website, kind of like Kickstarter or Indiegogo, but instead of, you know, funding one project, one movie, or one album like a lot of artists do. This is a way that people can kind of subscribe to what I'm doing for just a few dollars a month. And so that will be able to allow me to keep the site up. It'll fund my movie tickets, and then hopefully it will be able to snowball so that I can look to that for reliable income. And I think it's something that people will be turning to more and more, that this kind of model. It's as a shift from traditional print media. I mean, I know we have, there's a lot of different film websites out on the internet. You know, you can go to Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic and just see all these free reviews. But in terms of the local level, I think Asheville is a place that likes to support its own. I think that, well, kind of like what we're talking about before, the community wants their artists locally, and they want their coverage locally. So I think that as kind of a supplement to the other media sources around town, I feel like there are going to be journalists arising with a similar model, and people can kind of do this a la carte journalism where they can maybe support a local film critic, support a local food writer, support a local investigative journalist, and together kind of make their own electronic newspaper.
Yeah, I think so. I was just thinking about how, so I'm making the transition from North Carolina resident and New York professor to basketball coach. And even clicking on some sites, like there's a Hickory Husker website where it was just very specific articles about high school basketball in Indiana. And that was information that you can't get that anywhere but on this site. And that's something that if that's what your life is, that you're willing to pay for. So I think that's a great model. I look forward to following your site and see how that goes. I wanted to ask you about the range of, so for example, you recently wrote about The Circle, and that has Tom Hanks and Emma Watson in it. You're covering Netflix and Amazon. And then as someone who's participated in this sort of weekend movie making contest called the 48-Hour Film Project, I think I know that you've at least judged that a couple times. So, I mean, you're looking at stuff where people who've never made films are running around with their cell phones trying to make a movie, all the way up to $100 million films. Tell me about like shifting that lens of looking at that wide range of work.
I think you definitely do have to keep in mind what kind of resources the filmmaker had. I mean, you can't say, oh, well, you know, this 48-hour film project didn't have an original song from U2, so, you know, it's definitely not as good as this movie. You know, are they telling a good story? Is it generally well done? You know, with the way the technology has advanced, you know, you can make a pretty decent film on your iPhone or with other affordable technology. So, I just think that there are certain just sort of basic standards to filmmaking. You want a clear image. You want good sound. You know, as long as someone makes a film with these kind of basic components and tells a clear story, that's going to win me over just as much as a slick, big budget Hollywood film. So, I think you can see a filmmaker's intent pretty well, whether it's no budget or big budget.
So I think the same kind of question is, I noticed you wrote about American Pastoral, that's a Philip Roth novel. It's one of my favorite novels. But you also, I think, reviewed The Smurfs, right? So,
right.
I mean, when you're writing about The Smurfs and you're writing about, how do you do that? Is the audience is the audience the same? Does the audience change?
Well, I just I think some people, you know, I'll back when the Trolls movie came out, I hated that movie, but I just thought it was a bad movie, and I got some hate mail saying like, well, you know, it's only for the kids, you know, you have to look at it that way, and I thought, well, I did my best to look at it that way, but. I think for any film, I just go in and I sit down and I feel like I'm just ready to be entertained. You know, there's some of the best experiences I've had in the theater were where I just had no expectations and a movie came in and just completely surprised me, and it was a delight. So I just look at it that way, just kind of very open-minded. And I do try to think about who's watching it. So, you know, for the Smurfs, definitely there's going to be a lot of slapstick, and is it visually appealing? So if it works on those levels, I think, okay, yeah, it is going to be good for kids. But for the parents that are getting dragged along too, are there some jokes there? Is there music? Is there, what are the parents going to be doing other than watching their watches? So, it's a challenge, but I think it's important to bring all those aspects together and, let readers know if that movie is going to be worth their time or not.
Hate mail seems like a good sign to me. You know, hate mail over no mail, you know, you're getting a reaction. So another related to that a little bit, a couple Netflix, Amazon kind of question. So if I, if I know, I know Netflix and Amazon are putting out their own content now. Who else is doing that? That in addition to those two, that somebody should think about.
Well, I'd say HBO is doing a pretty good job with original film and also documentary. I guess they're kind of doing what Netflix is doing, where they're signing up with filmmakers early on in a project and saying, okay, well, we're going to be a co-producer. We're going to make sure that you have enough money to make this project, and then we're going to have it available on HBO, you know, for forever, essentially. And also Hulu, not as much on the film front, but on the miniseries front, they had a nice adaptation of the Stephen King's, what was it, 11/23/63.
Oh, right. I read that book.
JFK.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, James Franco was involved with that. I thought that was good. And then now we've got the Handmaid's Tale, the Margaret Atwood adaptation. So
my wife brought that up at breakfast this morning. Go ahead.
So I'd say those are kind of the main original content makers on the streaming side.
And then when you look at the streaming side, like, for example, my mom and dad, they don't check out any of that stuff. If you were going to point to, like, here's a couple things in those spaces that are worth looking at, what would you say?
Just some recommended titles that are,
yep,
that are exclusively on streaming.
That seems like your life, Edwin. Well, recommended titles. That's a big part of your life.
One that's really good right now on Netflix is this documentary called Five Came Back. Have you heard about that?
No.
So it's based on a book by Mark Harris, who's a very good writer, and it's about how these five very well-known Hollywood filmmakers, John Ford, John Huston, Frank Capra, William Wyler, and I'm blanking on the last one, but they were all making films in Hollywood, and then when World War II broke out, they got hired by the military to go and make propaganda films. And so it's about their journey and their experience overseas, and then sort of how that affected their filmmaking once they came back. And it's fascinating. It's a three-part documentary. Each one's about an hour long, and very well done.
Thanks. I will check that out. Two more questions for you, and I don't know how much you can talk about this. So when we hang up, you're heading off to a press conference. How much can you say about that?
Well, it's about Wicked Weed being purchased by InBev, which owns Anheuser-Busch, and so that's been a big deal. That was just announced yesterday, and so I'm going to just sort of find out what went into the deal and what kind of changes we can expect. And then there's also been a lot of local backlash to it because people feel a little betrayed by it. So I'm going to ask sort of their reactions to local perception and how they're going to deal with that.
So what would, I mean, there's a couple things that are, I mean, there's you probably having a better understanding of people's take, or here's a question you can answer.
Okay.
What are some of the things that people who feel betrayed, what are some of the things they're going to point to about feeling betrayed?
Well, I mean, you know, this is the first Asheville brewery to, everybody's independent, and this is the first one to be bought up by, you know, this big conglomerate. So and there's a feeling that you know, InBev and Anheuser-Busch, they're part of this system that makes things harder for the little guy. You know, they're lobbying for these laws that help them and hurt the smaller breweries, and then, you know, and then InBev's coming along and buying these smaller breweries and making it even harder for the new guys to get going. So I think there's, you know, with all the buy local and support local, I think that's where the betrayal feeling comes in. Now, I don't know exactly how accurate that is, but I mean, that was kind of the sentiment going around social media yesterday.
Is this kind of a, so if Google buys YouTube, or, you know, Microsoft or Facebook buys software company X, is it a similar kind of move, or is that too easy of a metaphor?
I think it's part of it, because basically it's, you know, one big corporation that just, you know, they're end up being smart, because there's not a brewery like Wicked Weed in their portfolio, so they want someone that's doing barrel aged and sour beers, so that they can tap into that market. So it's a very smart business move, I think. But I guess in my mind, something like YouTube, you know, was super big to begin with, so it's sure. almost like one of these, you know, Time Warner acquisitions. Yeah. And right. Wicked Weed still feels so. I mean, I know Wicked Weed is super successful, and they've got four facilities on the local front if you count on their production and distribution side. So, but it still feels so Asheville, so accessible. So it's just interesting to have something like that, you know, part of a now a nationwide and global entity.
So when you have something like New Belgium or Sierra Nevada, you wouldn't call those independent. Do you call those breweries? Where do they fit in? You know, if you're looking at New Belgium and you're thinking about Anheuser-Busch and you're thinking about Wicked Weed, what's that spectrum look like?
I know that, you know, like the Oscar Blues and Sierra and New Belgium, they're big, but I mean, they are still considered craft breweries, because they make, you know, less than a certain amount of of barrels per year. So they still qualify, even though they have a nationwide footprint.
I think a lot of that, you know, it's who the buyer is, who the audience is, how we feel about that. Do we kind of know who the people? Because I did the same, you know, I looked up, like, what makes a craft brewery, uh-huh. and it just came down to, like, whatever, production. It's more complex and trickier, isn't it, than just saying, you know, independent, craft brewery, big company. Certainly I can understand why people are upset that this thing they saw go from little to big in Asheville with people they knew making the beer. I get that. It's interesting to me. Let me finish off, and we kind of got to this a little bit, but I think there'll be people who will listen to this, and they'll be able to read, they'll be coming to Asheville, and they'll read a guidebook, and it'll tell them to go to the Biltmore House. What are some of your Asheville favorite places? I'm sorry, I added that. That was not in the questions that were sent before the podcast. I stuck you with that one.
Well, it's funny, because I'm kind of a homebody, and I like, you know, when I go out, you know, it's great that we have such a strong tourism arm here, but you know, it's to the point where, as a local, I have to kind of choose the times that I go to Wicked Weed or go to Burial, that it's not as crowded. So
absolutely.
Let's see. I mean, I would say, we have so many good restaurants here, and I'm a vegetarian, so I always try to point people to Plant.
Oh yeah.
To have a supper there. I think that's our gem, and definitely to check out the South Slope and West Asheville's beer scenes. I think a lot of people go have brunch at Sunny Point, but just across the street is Oyster House Brewing, which I think is one of the best kind of hidden gems in town in terms of brewing and food. And West Asheville is so neat to walk about. You know, we one thing we haven't talked about is how good our music scene is as well. We get so many great national acts coming through, and we have a good local music scene as well. And the Mothlight in West Asheville is a wonderful place to see a show. It's about 150 person capacity, but it's super clean. It's got probably the best sound system in town. You never have to wear earplugs when you're in there. It's just kind of a perfect music venue to go
That sounds good. No earplug sounds good to me.
Yeah.
See, I got three great... I've been here 3 years. I haven't been to Plant, Sunny Point, or the Oyster House, so I can do all that before I move, maybe.
That's right. Just make a big day of it.
So, Edwin, thanks for joining me. I look forward to reading what you have to say about the Wicked Weed sale in the next week or so.
Thanks, Bill. Yes, it'll be... let's see. It'll be on Mountain Express in... a little over a week.
All right, we look forward to it. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Don't mess with the bull, young man. You'll get the horns.